Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Today on Keeping the Faith, we're talking about changes in Amish life. And our guest today is Danny Otto. Welcome, Danny.
I'm happy to be here.
Danny is was born into an old order Amish family. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was born, and our address was Arcola. It's the Arcola Arthur community, and my father.
That's in Illinois.
In Illinois.
We have listeners in Indiana who have Amish communities nearby them, too.
That's about 30 miles south of Champaign-Urbana.
Okay.
And my father was operating my grandfather's 160-acre farm at that time. So we lived in the large house, and my grandparents had an attached house called the Doughty House adjacent to that.
Doughty meaning?
Grandpa.
Ah. Now, is that German?
They're German dialect, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And may I ask what year you were born?
I was born in 1953.
That's much later than me, so don't worry about that. Now, your parents were old order Amish. What does that mean?
The Amish had their start in Europe, and there were several streams after the Reformation. Lutheran and Reformed, Presbyterian, and so on. And there was a group known broadly as Anabaptists who believed in adult baptism. And the two primary groups associated with that today would be the Mennonite family of denominations and the Old Order Amish. And through much of that history, the two groups were virtually indistinguishable from each other, and at sometimes they were even called Amish Mennonite. And then in the late 19th century, as some of the Mennonite groups wanted to be more like a denomination and have national coordinating offices and features and so on, the Amish stuck with a congregational format. So every Amish congregation is autonomous.
And independent.
Independent. Okay. And so since they didn't follow the new way of having denominational, they were known as the old way or the old order.
Now, I've heard some Amish and Mennonites say that, we grew out of the Protestant Reformation, but we are not really Protestants, and yet we're not Catholics. We're something different. Can you explain that?
Well, I think what they mean by that is the pattern of the Reformation at the time in the areas that followed Martin Luther. If your prince converted to Martin Luther's position, everybody within that realm became Lutheran from Catholic. Or if you were in France or in Switzerland with John Calvin, you became Reformed. And the Anabaptist movement said that this should be a matter of free choice. An adult has freedom of conscience and has to choose. And so an infant can't choose to be baptized, so they ought not to be baptized. So they were known as rebaptizers. That's the term Anabaptist, because the first generation, of course, had been baptized once.
So as infants.
And so when they made this decision to take this new path as adults, they baptized themselves again. And, of course, that, strictly speaking, only applied to the first generation, but it was an epithet that endured. So the distinctive there was that whatever the religion of your ruler could not determine your own faith. And so we see the residue of that in our own country where we say separation of church and state.
Sure. Now, some of our listeners, I'm sure, are saying to themselves, how could someone who was born from an old order Amish family in Arthur, Illinois, now be talking on the radio about this, this very modern method? And some people are probably listening on their computers and they're listening on their cell phones and so forth. And so before I turn open the phone lines and let people ask their own questions. Answer that for me. What happened to you so that now that you ended up being a professor of philosophy at Eastern Illinois University?
When I was four, my parents, for a variety of reasons, left the Old Order Amish Church and joined a Mennonite church that allowed more of the modern technology, including radios. And so ultimately, when I was in my early 20s, I went to university, and I enjoyed that and couldn't quite get away from it.
Where did you go to university?
I began at Illinois State University and then at Notre Dame University and then at University of Toronto and the Pontifical Institute of Medieval Studies in Toronto.
And how many degrees have you?
Well, we don't talk about that. There's still a sense of
modesty.
Modesty.
But enough that you could be a professor.
Enough that I can be a professor.
Eastern Illinois University of Philosophy. Yeah. And yet you've maintained your ties, your family ties, your friendship ties beyond your Mennonite congregation here in Urbana, Illinois, with the Amish. How does that work? Are there not suspicions of people who leave the Amish?
I mean, the experience of those who leave the Amish, of course, would be varied depending on family and community.
Sure.
But at the time in 1957, when my parents made the change, they had other family members who did, particularly on my mother's side of the family. And, you know, there's tension involved, but, you know, family trumps and family ties trump. And so we were always included in family events and gatherings. And so I've got an extensive family tree on each side with, you know, 40-plus first cousins on one side and 50 on the other. And so
the Amish have large families.
The Amish have large families. And
no birth control?
That's something that we don't talk about much.
I see.
But children are seen to be a blessing, uh-huh. But family size is shrinking
to
as
what?
Their lifestyle changes. Well, from 8 or 9 to 5 or 6.
Okay.
And so one can sort of make what inferences are appropriate. It's a delicate topic I wouldn't take up with my friends.
All right. So you don't talk about educational achievements. You don't talk about sex. Are there other topics that are verboten?
None that come to mind. The fascinating thing—
Politics? Did you talk about politics?
Oh, yeah, very much about politics.
Ah, okay.
I always felt once I left that area and was studying that at family gatherings, it was assumed that I had read things and been exposed to things that they hadn't.
Sure.
And so I learned that I had to be very careful because what I said would be repeated. They're an oral culture and they spend a lot of time visiting.
Sure.
And, you know, if I said something or other, I could expect it to come around and, you know, I heard da-da-da-da-da-da.
It had better be true if you say it.
Well, my opinions, I felt like I wasn't ostracized. My opinions were respected, not as the truth, but as someone who...
had traveled?
Has traveled and read and studied.
Yes. Okay.
And so it's not necessarily that education is disrespected. It's just a choice that they don't make.
And the custom, as I recall, in previous conversations with folks who know about the Amish, is that about an eighth grade education is all that is kind of expected of the Amish young people.
That's right. And most of that is now done in their own schools since the Supreme Court ruling in 63 on Yoder versus Board of Education. They have the right to have their own schools, and they do. And so this has been going now for 50 years in the Arthur community. They've got 25 schools with about 600 students.
Where did that case, Yoder versus the Board of Education, originate?
Wisconsin, I believe.
Wisconsin.
Yeah, and then there were other parallel cases in Iowa and some other communities, but I think the Wisconsin was...
How many Amish are there in America?
I think around 280,000, maybe 300,000. They're a very rapid-growing group. And the only reason why they won't eventually take over is because they're starting from such a small base.
Sure.
But their rate of growth is faster than any other denomination, even including Southern Baptists or Mormons or others that very actively proselytize. And the Amish don't proselytize at all. So their growth is coming from natural growth.
And in fact, the Amish kind of do the opposite of proselytizing. They tell their teenagers, go off and consider something else for a year or two.
They have that period of time, yeah. When you turn 16, you're given free, a looser rein, free rein. And before you're baptized, so you're not a church member at that time, so you have not made a promise to live according to the rules of the church. And so, yeah, they want the choice to be a conscious choice. When you become baptized, then you agree to live by the rules and your life changes.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Danny Otto, who was born in an Old Order Amish family in near Arthur, Illinois. As his parents moved to being Mennonite, he grew up Mennonite and continues to be in that Christian denomination, but he has maintained his family ties and friendship ties with the Amish. So although he's now a professor of philosophy at Eastern Illinois University, he's willing to share with us today what the changes have been in Amish life over the last several decades. We have several things we're going to talk about: their growing affluence that we've already mentioned, their growing population, their attitudes towards education. We'll talk about how healthcare affects them and the new technologies and what happens when they move from farming into manufacturing and get very successful and wealthy. We'll talk about all that in the minutes to come. But let me throw open the phone lines and let listeners also join this conversation. The number in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're listening long distance, perhaps even online, anywhere in the country, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455 to join this conversation. Your call will be answered by Kyle Croa, our engineer, and she'll put you in line to talk with our guest today, Danny Otto. Well, Danny, let's talk a little bit while we wait for phone calls about the population growth. What are some of the effects of that on the community?
The Amish organize themselves, the community, into geographical church districts.
So parishes, you could say?
They don't use the term parish. They use the term district.
A district.
And
okay.
They actually take a plat book and draw lines on it in order to divide up the families because they don't have church buildings. Worship is in the home. And so surprisingly, their homes are designed so they can accommodate 100 to 120 or 30 people for a church service.
These are typically farmhouses.
Well, they were.
Used to be.
They used to be,
okay.
But not so much anymore. And so as the population grows, it means that these districts are constantly shifting and being redesigned. But you don't get a hot young preacher and everyone flock across the community to that congregation away from their own. Everyone goes to the church in their geographical unit. And if you move, then you also, if you move out of that district, then you also have, you know.
Now, redistricting is a hot topic, of course, politically. How do the Amish do it? Who decides?
At the point at which a church district is getting to be unwieldy, 30 families or so, they start the process of talking. And sometimes they simply divide one district into two, or sometimes they will take some families from another district that's getting a little large, so out of two districts make three. But each district has church services every second Sunday. And so they have a list, their District A and District B, so you know where church will be held on a given Sunday. They have a little periodical that comes out for the Amish, so you have the list of families who are hosting church services the next week.
Okay.
And you can go visit any district that you would wish to. You would expect to attend yours, on the Sunday it's having services. But on the off Sunday, then you would go visit other places in the community.
Would a Amish family typically do that, go to church every Sunday but once in their district and then the next time somewhere else.
Yeah. I see. And, you know, sometimes they might not, if there's somebody in a hospital for a long term, say in a hospital on a Sunday, they might do a hospital visit rather than go to a church. But typically they would go every Sunday, but it would be to visit. And
what does the host family have to do to prepare for 100 people to come who are showing up for church that day?
Well,
in their home.
So, you know, you can do the math, 52 weeks a year, and you've got 25 families, more or less, and 25 Sundays that your district, so about once a year you're going to be hosting. So then for several weeks in advance, you have everyone come together and clean. And so you get everything thoroughly cleaned and if it needs fresh painting or whatever.
Do people sit down?
Oh, yes. They have pew wagons. The pews fold up. And so everything you need to host church is in this wagon.
So you clear your stuff out of the room.
You clear your stuff. You take your furniture out and put it in an outbuilding. And now more and more actually, and you know, with the increasing affluence, some of the Amish families are actually building a space that they call a utility room or something, but is actually
a church.
That an exterior space that, you know, is finished out with the ceiling that they can put up the benches and so on.
Uh-huh.
So they don't have to do it in the house,
of
and
course.
That makes it easier.
Uh-huh. But if the old way, when you do it in your house, you put your furniture in some other building, clean up that room and the bathrooms and everything else, I suppose, the kitchen, because you serve
everything
food.
Everything.
Right.
And at times, you know, weddings are especially large, and in the older two-story houses, that would include cleaning everything out of the upstairs bedrooms. And so you would have people scattered through two floors, and the preacher would stand. They designed the ground floor so they have removable panels so you can have a large space. But sometimes
between the rooms.
Ah. So
There'd be studs there somewhere, but there'd be panels, so it'd be open. You could hear
so you could hear, and then also in the upstairs space. So, you know, sometimes there would be pews in the upstairs bedrooms with 20 or 30 people in each bedroom.
Collapsible pews.
Collapsible pews without backs.
Okay.
So these are very compact.
Huh.
And
uncomfortable?
Uncomfortable, yes.
How long do the services last?
Well, it varies. A typical church service would last approximately 2 hours.
With two different sermons?
Or three.
From different people.
From different people. So,
tell us who the preachers are, how they become preachers.
Each district will have a bishop who does not have the regalia or sort of the prestige that you associate with high church bishops like Catholic. It
or
really
Lutheran
means more like
Methodist.
Lead pastor.
A lead pastor.
For that congregation. But they use the German term bishop.
Uh-huh.
And then they have two ministers who also have the capacity to preach, and a deacon, or the amadina, which means a servant of the poor who looks after the financial sort of needs. So you would have four people in leadership. And when there's a vacancy and they need to fill it, they use a lottery. And so the congregation, they have a series of Sundays where they're preparing for this, and the sermons might be designed to get people to think. And then all of the members submit a name, both men and women members, file through with the ministers and suggest someone that they think would be qualified. And everybody who has at least three votes is put in the lot. And then at the ordination service, there are hymn books, one for each person in the lot. So if there's seven there, and one of them has a slip with a Bible verse, and I can't quote the verse, it's from the Old Testament. The model for the lottery comes out of the Old Testament. Then also when they needed to fill out Judas committed suicide, and they needed, they used a lot.
To replace one of the
12
disciples.
So then the men, one after another, draw out a book. Only men. And when the bishop opens a book and finds the slip of paper, that man will then be ordained on the spot. And
you go to this meeting not knowing if you'll be ordained as one of the ministers, preachers, pastors, deacons or not.
That's right. One of the promises.
Can you say no?
No. One of the promises you make at baptism, both men and women are baptized, and in their baptismal promises among those is to follow the rules of the church. But the males who are baptized also promise to serve as minister if called.
If called. By lot.
By lot.
By chance. Yeah. Or is it by...
No, they wouldn't...
They would not say that?
They use the lot, but they're not thinking about lottery in the sense of, let's go buy the megabucks. They think that this is the way God works his will.
So they think that God is choosing this person through this method.
Yes. And there's a very strong sense. I mean, I know some of my cousins who were ordained, and one in particular. He knew an ordination was coming up, and he had sleepless nights. He had this sense, it's going to be me.
Oh.
And it was. And so it was not a surprise to him.
Was he dreading it?
Yes, because it's both a position of high responsibility, but because they actually believe that this is not an election by humans, that God's hand is on you, and that's a sort of a tremendous sense. So
it's a heavy weight.
It is a heavy weight.
Or kid.
And you feel the burden.
Uh-huh.
I have to say, you know, over my years of travel and education, I've worshipped with about every variety of Christian and other sort of group. And the Amish method of selecting qualified people for leadership and preaching is at least as good as the seminary training approach. They have some very, very excellent people, right. And others that not so much, but it's not easily dismissed, this approach to finding qualified people.
Let me give the telephone numbers again and invite listeners to join this conversation today on Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host. I'm talking today with Danny Otto about changes in Amish life. If you'd like to join this conversation, we encourage you to do that. Call 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois listing area within the area code of 217. But if it's long distance, there's a number you can punch in, 1-800-222-9455. And of course, let me remind listeners, if you've missed part of this program or are having a driveway moment where you'd like to hear the end but you really have to get to something else, of course, these programs in a week or two will be archived on the WILL website, and you can listen to this at your convenience. Just go to WILL.illinois.edu/keepinthefaith. And just take the G out of keeping, and you'll find all of our past programs that go back for 8 or 9 years. So you can find this one and listen to it at your convenience. Well, we have several folks waiting to join the conversation. So let's go to line number one. You're on the air with our guest today, Danny Otto.
Thank you. My name is Janice. I'm a pet sitter in town. And so I'm interested in the controversy over Amish puppy mills.
I'm not an expert on that. I'm aware that, you know, there are some Amish who breed dogs for sale.
Do you know any?
I don't know any.
Mm-hmm. How, in general, do the Amish treat their animals?
Well, I think the intention is to treat them very well. But, you know, again, there can be differences of opinion on what that entails. So I don't want to say that they're not cases of things that would clearly be abuse. You know, I'm not interested in defending or commenting on anything in specific. I don't know anything more about this than what I read occasionally in the newspaper.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
What animals would typically be in an Amish household or farm?
Traditionally, you know, animals are not household. They wouldn't have household pets, although now that more Amish are no longer farming, it's a little more common to find a small house dog. But in the old days when Amish were farming, they tended to be diversified, you know, with chickens, dairy, horses, of course, for animal traction, pigs. Now, with most Amish who are not farming, they still need to have a horse to pull their buggy, their transportation. And so you might find some more novelty animals. So I know people, you know, have elk or whatever sort of the latest sort of thing around as pets or some sort of a side project. But the horse is something that every Amish family has to have at least one to pull their transportation.
We'll follow up on that, but we have a couple other callers, and I see I made a mistake and pushed a button that I shouldn't have, and we disconnected someone. I hope they'll call back. In the meantime, let's go to line number four, someone who's on the road with a cell phone. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. I'm curious if the Amish share the older Christian tradition of Christmas being somewhat a secondary holiday. As you know, in the past 150 years or so, in most Christian traditions and indeed popular culture, Christmas has become the major Christian holiday in many people's eyes. Could you comment on that?
Thank you for the call.
The Amish do celebrate Christmas, but by popular standards, it would be quite muted and would focus more on occasions for family gatherings and meals. There's some gift giving, but it would be of a very modest nature.
Mainly things homemade?
Not necessarily. Okay. Books, games, perhaps things homemade. Children maybe make something for their parents. But it would not be a time of lavish gift giving, and then no decorations, or no Christmas trees or this sort of thing, you know, that one associates with popular Christmas.
No video games?
No video games, no.
We'll talk about the attitudes of the Amish toward technology more in the second half of the program, but in the meantime, let's go to a caller on line number one. Yes, go right ahead.
Yes, am I on?
Yes, you are.
My question would be, one hears in many media discussions that the Amish group as a whole is growing because of biological growth. Could you comment on the fact and maybe give a ballpark percentage of the percentage of young people that they retain in the group?
It is almost exclusively by biological growth. It is possible if someone sincerely wants to join the Amish and is patient and
persistent.
Persistent to the degree that they don't lose interest before the process is done. It's possible, and it happens, and sometimes, you know, quite successfully. But it would be primarily biological, and you can sort of do the math. If your family size, I think it's running close to six, and the retention rate is nationwide is between 85% and 90%.
My goodness.
You can do the math, and I think the population is doubling about every 17 to 20 years.
I remember going, I went to Goshen College. I grew up Mennonite, and I remember hearing an Amish bishop talk, and he talked about a professor who once taught at Notre Dame came and asked to join the group. According to you, there are not many stories of outsiders joining the Amish. Would that be accurate?
There are not many. I might actually know. I mean, what you're saying is close enough to a story, similar story, that I might know the person you're talking about who was a student at Notre Dame.
Was a student, okay.
And he's now a highly respected member of the Old Order Amish, works at Pathway Publishers, an Amish publishing enterprise in Aylmer, Ontario. And he writes extensively, and he has an Amish historical library and archive because the training he got at University of Illinois in history and then a master's in history at Notre Dame makes him very well qualified to do that sort of specialized work. But, you know, I can go any place and mention his name and people know his writings and so on. And I visited him. Even though he wasn't raised Amish, in 30 minutes I had this sense that, you know, probably he wasn't. And I was at Notre Dame at the time, and he soon giggled and went over and started pawing through a closet and pulled up a degree and then started asking me about people we knew in common there. But so it happens, and he's a very welcome member of their community.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. Thank you for calling. We're about halfway through our program today, talking with Professor Danny Otto from Eastern Illinois University, a professor of philosophy there. How long have you been at Eastern, Danny?
since 1993.
And what sort of things do you teach in philosophy?
Well, my graduate work was in medieval philosophy, Neoplatonism, up through the 12th century before the Aristotelian revival. We're an undergraduate university there, and so we do have a substantial number of majors, but my opportunity to teach that is not very often. So I've been teaching ethics, some introductory level courses, some ancient philosophy, and recently we're branching into religious studies, so we're developing a religious studies curriculum, which falls on me.
My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host of these Keeping the Faith programs, although I'd like to, especially at this moment, thank Stan Yankus and Don Nolan for filling in the last 2 weeks when I was busier traveling. But it's good to be back, and I was able to listen to their programs partially when I was far away via the Internet and partially as they were archived, and I was when I returned, and they did a wonderful job, and I want to thank them again for filling in here on Keeping the Faith. Coming up next week, we'll be talking about the Youth Literature Festival with the director of that festival, Beth Vriendenberg, and with an author who's going to be making a presentation during that festival, Alice McGinty, a local Champaign-Urbana author, the author of, among other books, many books actually, but one particular one we'll be talking about next week is Thank You World, a children's book. On October 7, we'll continue our little mini-series here on the Amish. We'll be talking with Wilmer Otto, same last name, about the Amish and the U.S. government. Wilmer has been on the board of the Amish Interpretive Center in Arcola. Danny, are you and Wilmer related? You have the same last name?
We are. He's my brother.
And your brother.
I'm also on the board of the Illinois Amish Interpretive Center. So
two brothers we have. Here I didn't even know you were brothers.
Yeah, well, I didn't know he was showing up October 7th. So.
How many other siblings have you?
My parents had 9 children, and 8 of us survive.
How many in this area still?
There are 4 of us in this area.
How many others might be willing to be on this radio program?
Well, you do remote guests, so I suppose you could have about any of them.
Let me remind folks that support for Keeping the Faith has come for many years from the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Friday forums continue at the University Y. The one I was able to attend last Friday was just magnificent, and I heard the one before that was too, although I had to miss it. So check those out on the Y website. Go to universityymca.org, and you can click on Friday forum and see what's coming up each week. The programs are at noon, and they're free. You can pick up a lunch there at the Y Eatery, good Thai food. And if you like, or you can bring a lunch or simply listen to the free lecture and ask questions afterwards. This whole series is dealing with issues of the current political campaign, and so they're very current and some really excellent speakers. Well, let's get back to our guest here on Keeping the Faith, Danny Otto. Let's talk a little bit about the increasing affluence of the Amish. Here they are, people who are dedicated to maintaining a simple way of life. They typically drive around in a buggy with following a horse, and yet some of them have become very wealthy. How has that happened?
It's happened because of the transition from an ag economy to small industry and shops. And the Amish have a very strong work ethic. Work is seen as a good. And so even when you talk to people in their 70s or so and you say, how are you doing? Well, you know, I'm still able to get out in my shop and work a little bit every day, and that's a good thing.
Sure.
So what happened, some of the things that they moved into, they're very adept. So woodworking, they're associated with that. A lot of people don't know that they have a lot of machine shops and welding shops, fabricating some fairly high-end sophisticated equipment. And So in the woodworking industry, without necessarily intending to, if you're making kitchen cabinets and people like them, this is very ironic. The suburban sprawl west of Chicago with the flourishing of $500,000 McMansions has made some of the Amish been very good for them, because contractors come down, order kitchen cabinets. And if you have a $100,000 kitchen cabinet ordered for a house that the Amish have never seen in Chicago, there's money left on the table once you've paid your expenses. And so that has worked very well for them. Some of them are also in home building, so there would be contractors who travel to Champaign-Urbana, Decatur, around to build these homes. And if you're industrious and work hard and have a good work ethic and build well, you'll make money at the end of the day.
And yet you go home to a house that has no electricity and no telephone.
That's the ironic thing. For them to do these sorts of things and to be efficient and competitive, you know, they have to use the current technology. And so the Amish church has been very selective in how they allow technologies in and what they disallow. And the theme seems to be their community values are paramount, and so things that could be a disruption to that are things that they tend to disallow, and sometimes retroactively. My grandfather in the 1920s was the first farmer, Amish or otherwise, in Moultrie County to have a row crop tractor that you could take to the field to do field work rather than a stationary power plant like a steam engine. And that increased productivity immensely, and several years later they decided that that wasn't the good way to go. They'd like to have this community reliance, so you helped each other bale hay and harvest and so on.
And not count on a machine.
And so that tractor went, and he got rid of the tractor, and they stopped using it.
And went back to a horse.
To horse-drawn. So now, I mean, that's
that
history.
That has continued.
That has continued to this day.
Once that policy was made, it sort of spread to the other independent congregations and the other communities?
Different communities have different practices.
Okay.
So
you'll
find some Amish communities that allow tractors to be used in the field.
Okay.
But the
most
current—
Most don't. Yeah.
The current sort of sensitive area is with the advent. They don't allow you to hook into the electrical grid.
Okay.
But they have always allowed batteries for flashlights and so on. And then for specialized needs, so you needed to have a battery to have lighting for your horse and buggy so it'd be safe on the road. So you've got a diesel power plant with some alternators that are charging batteries. And then you can use them also now with cordless power tools, you know, to charge up power tools. So with the great cordless technology for construction work, you really don't need to have a cord plugged into anything to build a house as long as you can recharge your batteries, which they can do.
Tell me, what's so bad about the electrical grid?
Well, I think it's an issue they're going to have to deal with sooner or later, because they are adopting the electrical equivalent in so many ways.
The diesel-powered.
Well, with the diesel-powered things, now there's a father and son who are very sophisticated in designing electronic circuit boards, and they design solid-state circuitry to power
Amish father and son.
Yeah, to power fans. So the Amish haven't had fans. It's very hot in their house in the summertime, no air conditioning, no fans.
Sure.
So they have got 12-volt fans. They've got manufacturing companies in China making these. They're sending them over here, assembling them. And with a little 12-by-12 UV array outside your window, you can keep this thing charged up, and every night you've got air in your bedroom, you know, which is something very innovative. Well,
so the Amish have gone to solar power, over completely the whole electric history.
They've gone to solar power to power some things, and also wind power. So they've always had windmills back, you know, for certain things. But now
to
you can find small electrical generating windmills, none of the massive ones yet. But
so the churches and some districts allow you to put up a windmill to generate power to run your machinery to make the things you want to make to sell, but not to have lights in your house.
That's right.
Ah.
But with LEDs being so efficient now, I go into Amish homes, and so, you know, a nighttime bathroom lamp can be an LED light, which has almost no draw, and you can have rechargeable batteries and so on. So,
A fine line.
It's a fine line, and the Amish, it's not the technology per se. They try to sort this way into how will this affect the way I live my life and interact with others. And, you know, I have taken some sustainability classes from U of I down on field trips, and some of the larger Amish industries that might have 70 employees and have huge power needs, furniture shops and so on, it's hugely inefficient to have a 1,000 horsepower stationary diesel generator that's generating hydraulic power, air power, and electrical power rather than simply hooking into the grid. And they're very aware of this. Yeah. And that's why I think sooner or later something will change.
Let me give the phone numbers again. We have another 16 minutes or so on this program with Danny Otto talking about changes in Amish life. Do call us with a question or comment. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, long distance. 800-222-9455.
One of the technology issues that I would like to talk about, because I'm so fascinated by it, and I was visiting with a friend yesterday and pushing him on it, and, you know, in my childhood, when Amish needed to use a phone to call a doctor or something, they went to a non-Amish neighbor and used the phone and made a call. Then when you had some Amish who had a business with clients who said, I can't deal with you if I have to mail you a letter and you mail me back. So they allowed them to have what they call a phone shack, essentially a phone booth, exterior of their business and home, where you could go and receive and make calls for your business.
Yeah.
And then the contractors soon who are out on the job site need to have instant communications. And so
For materials
and clients and so on.
Sure.
And so now cell phones. Well, now, but there's not supposed, when you get home, you don't take them into the house. You're not supposed to have cell phone.
In the house.
But,
or the barn or.
But you can use them for your business. But okay. Of course now, cell phones are becoming smartphones. You've got a web browser on it. And
you
know, that's going to become a real challenge because with digital technology that everything is becoming more and more accessible.
Sure. And it's not of a phone. It's also a television and YouTube and music.
You know, that's always been the concern with having a telephone in the house is the way it disrupts family life.
Sure.
Or if you're hooked up to the grid and have a TV and so on, you watch TV, you don't go visit your neighbors.
Right. Or radio.
Right.
So Amish could call us today.
They can go out to the booth and call us. They could.
But they're not listening.
We
have two callers who are, maybe three now. Let's see. In what order do we go? Line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Line one.
Yes. I've always been treated in a very friendly way when I have visited their Amish shops and things. And I'm wondering, what is the general attitude? How do people feel about, say, other religions? Is there an appreciation, a respect, a hostility?
Fear?
There's not hostility. And, you know, there might be maybe some fear based on ignorance, but generally the Amish are a lot less judgmental than people assume they are. When you look at someone who lives such a rigorous lifestyle, you tend to think, well, surely they must think that in some crucial way the rest of us aren't living up to it. But they don't see it that way.
Ah.
You choose to make this lifestyle, and if you choose to, then you need to do it. And if you didn't choose to, then we don't judge you.
I see.
And so they tend to be very open. They enjoy having friendships among non-Amish, and any time I go to a wedding or funeral, there'll be non-Amish families there and always make sure that they get a good seat and are treated respectfully and warmly.
Do the Amish read about other religious traditions, faiths, beliefs, practices?
They do. And there's a story I really like. One of my Amish cousins, who was a minister, had people come to him, Muslims from this community, found him because they saw they were looking for sheep, and they needed for halal purposes. They needed to know how they were slaughtered and needed to do them themselves. They needed to buy live sheep. And they figured out that the Amish might have them and asked around. They found him. So for a number of years, people would come from this community and buy sheep with the agreement that they could actually slaughter them on his farm and clean everything up and take it with them.
To follow the Muslim requirements.
Right, to follow their requirements.
For their religious
traditions. Yeah, similar
to
kosher.
And the Amish were very open to that.
He was very open to it. Uh-huh. And so, you know, he and his boys are very curious because you get out your prayer rug and you say your prayers and, you know, put a blessing on the sheep. And so they had questions. And so one day, you know, John says, well, do you mind if I ask you some questions? And the guy says, well, sort of, you're equally strange. Do you mind if I ask you some questions? And so they agreed to ask each other questions, and neither was trying to persuade the other of the truth of their religion. And it was just a time of sharing of perspectives and experiences.
As you know, Danny, this program has focused a lot over the last 13 years on interreligious dialogue and trying to promote it. But this is the first time I've heard of Amish-Islam dialogue.
That was Amish-Islam dialogue.
We have a caller on line number 4 who's traveling in Indiana. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. I've really enjoyed listening to your program. I grew up near Arthur and went to grade school with Amish children and often drive through that Amish community that you've been speaking of. My main question, I think, today is, what sort of special medical problems do the Amish face today? And I don't know much about their relationship with the medical community, but that would be my main question, the kinds of medical problems general to the Amish population. Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Thank you, Danny.
Amish in general do face a problem with congenital defects because their gene pool is not expanding. They need to. There's no easy solution to that without proselytizing, taking in some others. This community has less of that than some of the eastern communities because it's a kind of crossroads, and so Amish from other places are crossing back and forth. But they do have a higher incidence of certain sorts of congenital problems than the general population. Generally, their attitude towards health care is, we like it. They use conventional medicine, all of the whatever technologies are available for treatment.
From pharmacies,
cancer treatments, and so on. And they use every variety of folk medicine and ethnic medicine, from Asian cures to whatever. It's all good.
Maybe.
Well, in the sense that, you know, they're open to it.
Okay.
And they like the idea that there might be some fruit or vegetable or something that, you know, could work a miracle.
Sure.
But in the meantime, generally they'll use hospitals and doctors. And that's a real challenge now because you can have an infant that's born several weeks premature and have a bill of $30,000 or $40,000 before you get the child home.
Right.
And they don't have medical insurance.
Why is that?
To insure against an act of God seems to be a kind of lack of trust.
So the Amish would feel that anything that happens is somehow God's will?
They do believe that God is in control, and there is this sense, it's a kind of muted fatalism, that God will give you things and that you can bear them and work them out. So they don't insure themselves against act of God, but they do now insure others. So it's acceptable to have certain forms of liability insurance. So if you're a contractor or so on, you need to be able to insure others who don't share your faith.
Who work with you. Okay. And the Amish, I've learned from you, sometimes go to Mexico or Canada where there's a better health system for everybody to have certain procedures, knee replacement, hip replacement, operations, dental procedures?
The Amish are sort of the dream population for those who believe that we should all be market-oriented and become sophisticated healthcare consumers and buy on the basis of cost, because since they do understand what procedures cost, they do shop. And so it's very common. I see somebody, you know, where you've been, well, I just got back from Mexico and I went down with my brother and he had a knee done or something like that.
It was cheaper there.
It was cheap, much cheaper there, or sometimes Canada.
Huh.
And so they can go there and for $15 have a procedure that would be $50,000 here, and take family along, take the train, have a holiday, and come back and still be $30,000 ahead.
Wow. We have two callers waiting on the phones, but someone called in who didn't want to go on the air, but I want to ask you their question. I see the Amish in the fields with a brace of horses pulling a farm implement of some sort that's powered by a gigantic steam engine or diesel or something. It rivals a Rube Goldberg experiment. How is this more simple than just running, and here I'll change the language a little bit, than just running the darned equipment?
People like this, you can find lots of anachronisms, and this is one of them.
Sure.
And so for harvesting corn, for example, my father, every ear was plucked by hand and thrown into a wagon and then shoveled out by hand and so
right.
on. So then you get a corn picker, but you have to have some sort of power to operate the chains and so on.
That takes the corn off of it.
Right. And so they have an engine cart that powers the tool and then horses pulling this. Well, why don't you just have a tractor?
Sure.
Well, okay, maybe you need, you know, 50 horsepower tractor to do this two-row picker. But if I had a 100-horsepower tractor, I could do twice as much work. And then if I had a 200-horsepower tractor, I could farm 500 acres.
Yeah.
Then, well, let's get this, and then let's do 1,000 acres. And then soon
acres.
I'm...
Yeah. And so, where's the community at
so
all
that's,
that?
Yeah. That's... It lets them have some power in the field, but you're not going to get beyond that sort of 160-acre base that they're comfortable with.
I do see that. Let's go to line number two, a caller waiting. Yes, line two.
Hi. We have a family farm in north central Ohio, and Amish and what we call Iron Wheel Mennonite neighbors, as well as Car Mennonite neighbors. And I have friends among both groups. I took over to my Amish friend, Old Order Amish, a solar-powered light that I'd run across and thought she might be interested in. And she looked at it politely, and we tried it out. I went over as the sun was setting, and pretty soon it was the only light in the kitchen as we were talking. But she said she wasn't interested, and she said they would say that if it was on the windowsill, someone would steal it, and it would also lead to solar-powered electric fences. And then she pulled out of her pocket a little headlamp. It's the same kind that I use to do plumbing and electrical work, and it has LED lights. And she said, but I really like this. And she said, when these appeared, nobody said anything with a smile on her face. But clearly in her particular community, in her particular church group, the decision had been made that you don't have the solar-powered lights. The other thing that I'm noticing is there's a lot of competition for farmland in this particular area, and farmland prices are going up because of the large families, and people are also having to leave the area and go to places where the land may not be quite so good in order to be able to farm. And one parcel of land was bought for an enormous amount of money and doesn't actually have that much arable land on it, but they're going to clear the woods and drain the swamps. And I'm thinking, this is not good for the environment to have large families so that you have to, if you want to farm, you have to keep clearing more and more land.
Thank you for that comment and question. Danny, response?
Well, generalizations about the Amish are always tricky because they're congregational. So
sure.
There are variations community to community and within a district in a community. So you know, what you say.
How many districts around Arthur?
There are 29 districts at Arthur.
Each independent congregation makes these decisions. Yeah. We have two callers waiting. We may not get to both of them because of time. Let's go to number one. Yes, line one. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. You've commented on Amish success in, you know, in industry or businesses, but what about, are there any Amish poor, or where there is, you know, where I know that they collaborate very well on, you know, having dinners for raising money for health care expenses, but what about, are there any Amish poor, and or how do they handle that?
Thank you for the question. Danny?
Well, poor is a relative term, and they're not Amish poor in the sense of homeless and that sort of thing. But
why not?
Well, because they look out for each other, and you've got family and your congregation and the deacons and so on.
No alcoholism?
No is an absolute term.
Okay.
But it would be very uncommon.
Okay.
So, you know, there are families that are not as good managers as others, and so typically what they would do is ask them to accept the guidance of someone with their finances or maybe a committee and make sure that there's employment available and so on and give them some guidance. But they're not all universally skilled in finances, but you wouldn't have poor in the sense of people on food stamps and these sorts of things.
We have one more caller. You have 20 seconds for a question or comment.
Okay, thank you. What about those who have permanent physical disabilities? I'm really curious as to what, you know, real physically oriented society, limited machines to do. What is the position of those with physical disabilities?
There was an echo. I didn't. The question was about those with disabilities?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. They make various adaptations, so they will, sometimes they're children who need electric chairs to get around and so on, and so they would use those sorts of things. But they have special schools for children with disabilities, so they have their own special ed program. But they make every effort to figure out a way for these people to be productive members of the community insofar as they're able. So even if they have a handicap, they would figure out some way to be inclusive.
There was recently in the newspaper a very small little ad, it looked like, saying if you want to contribute to a certain Amish person who and her family who writes for the paper, here's a way to do that at a bank. Was that legitimate? Since the Amish seem to find ways to take care of themselves, was that a something someone dreamed up?
I can't comment on it specifically because I don't know the details. Amish in general would not put a notice in the newspaper soliciting things, but they would have community fundraisers, meals and so on,
fundraising meals
and auctions. But to actually put a notice in a general newspaper.
Uh-huh. I've loved the News Gazette article written by Billy Otto. Is she a relative?
Her husband is my second cousin.
Second cousin. We need to stop. We're out of time, but let me thank Danny Otto, our guest today, talking about changes in Amish life. He was born in an old order Amish family, but now teaches philosophy at Eastern Illinois University, and we've been delighted to have him on the program today. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works, Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, W.